I'm afraid of us. So said Ralph to Piggy. Remember that? In William Golding's book, you may have studied it at school, Lord of the Flies, a fictional account of some schoolboys stranded on a desert island during a period of war after a plane had crashed. Just a group of schoolboys. And the book describes what happens to this group away from civilization, away from adults and any restraining influences. Ralph becomes the group leader, and pretty soon there are tensions as Jack wants to become the group leader, and two groups form and there are fights. And eventually it leads to Jack's group killing one of the other boys. It's not true, of course. William Golding wrote it as fiction. But what if it were true? Well, at a very similar time in history, a study was going on in a place called Robbers Cave State Park. 22 boys, aged 12, were let loose in a deserted scout camp by a team of psychologists. Boys were given food, shelter, and almost complete independence. The aim of the experiment was to generate friction between two groups of strangers and then bring them together to resolve their differences, to cooperate with each other. The participants thought they were attending an ordinary school summer camp. The boys selected were intelligent from very similar backgrounds. The researchers pretended to be camp staff and melted into the background. Boys were divided into two different groups. They later named their groups. One were the Rattlers, one were the Eagles. In phase one of the experiment, each group was left alone for a week to do fairly ordinary activities, camping, hiking, swimming. Both established their own hierarchies, unaware of the other group's existence. Phase two of the experiment, the second week, they were allowed to hear the other group in the distance, which sparked immediate signs of rivalry between these two groups. The announcement by the staff of a tournament between them sparked more hostility. As soon as they set eyes on each other, the two groups' insults started to fly. After losing an early contest, the Eagles got rid of their leader, who wasn't doing a good job. And a more aggressive boy seized power and straight away said that if you're not going to work hard, then I'm going to beat you up. The first day ended with the Eagles seizing the Rattlers' flag and burning it. Then the Rattlers destroyed the Eagles' flag. Fights erupted. The researchers had to break them up. Later, the Rattlers executed a night raid on the Eagles' camp, wearing full war paint to terrify the enemy. They raced into the cabin unopposed, smashing and stealing. The Eagles leader rounded on his defeated boys, and they then carried out a counterattack on the Rattlers' camp, armed with sticks and baseball bats. Mission accomplished, they retreated and rearmed with socks filled with stones. Psychologists watched the fights escalate over the following days, until finally one violent brawl meant they had to step in and separate them. Lord of the Flies could have been true. It was true. Why did that happen? They were children. Once they grow up and learn to be civilized adults, we don't do that anymore. But is that really true? Look at the world around us. I'm afraid of us. Ralph was right to be afraid of us. Just like G.K. Chesterton wrote to the newspapers when they were asking for answers to what's the problem with the world, G.K. Chesterton wrote in, "Dear sir, I am." We are the problem in the world. We seem incapable of living together in love. So what is the solution. How do we live together in love? And we're going to think about that today. We're restarting our series in Exodus, which we were doing last year around this time. And this summer, we're going to finish this series. We're going to go through chapters 20 to 40, covering large chunks at a time. Today, we're going to look at four chapters. So let me give you a recap of where we've got to. At the start of the book of Exodus, God's people, the Israelites, are in Egypt. They're there because Jacob came down with his extended family, around 70 people, to look for food. There was a famine at the time, and there was food in Egypt. And they were treated well by the Pharaoh, the leader of Egypt at that time, who gave them good land and food and peace. But later arose a different Pharaoh, a different leader of Egypt, who didn't know Jacob, who didn't know Joseph, and didn't like these Israelites who were different and who were growing and multiplying, and pretty soon a vast multitude, and he felt threatened. So he enslaved them and put them to forced labor. In the beginning of Exodus, the Israelites are a vast multitude in slavery under Pharaoh in Egypt. Israelites cry out to God in their slavery. God listens to their cry and he comes to rescue them, sending Moses. Moses performs 10 plagues, judgments on the land, plagues of turning the water into blood, plagues of sending flies and gnats and frogs and locusts to eat the harvest and hailstones to kill the livestock, until finally the last plague of judgment on the firstborn, killing the firstborn of the Egyptians. Pharaoh, in his grief and anger, sends the Israelites away. Go, you can leave. You can go and worship your God. By the way, there are handouts. There are some at the front here. You may have been given one when you came in. And that may well help you follow through a large chunk of scripture. So do come and grab one if you want. And if you don't want to come to the front, just want to stick a hand up, then I'm sure a member of the welcome team will be able to hand one up to anyone with a hand up. No one's got a hand up, so you're all fine. Let's carry on. So Pharaoh lets the people go, but then he regrets his decision, says, why have we let our workforce go? Sends his army after them. They go and they want to attack the army. God parts the Red Sea. The Israelites go through the Red Sea. God brings the sea together and destroys the Egyptian army. The first half of the book of Exodus is about God rescuing his people. Rescue them with great acts of judgment, the plagues, and then the Red Sea destroying the Egyptian army. So rescue the first half. Then the second half of the book is about what happens after they have been rescued. I suppose one option could have been that Israelites turn to God and they say, well, thank you very much. That's great that we're now free. We're just going to go off and do our own thing, okay? Thanks for the step up, but we'll be right from here. That could have been one option, couldn't it? But God had a plan for them. He hadn't just rescued them to be free from slavery, but free to be his people. Free to live a new life with him. Exodus 6:6-8 summarize what God was planning. Therefore say to the Israelites, I am the Lord and I'll bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them and I'll redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I'll take you as my own people and I will be your God. Then you'll know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord your God. Summarizing what he's doing in Exodus. And we see three things in those verses. Rescue, relationship, residing. He rescues his people from Egypt for a relationship with him, to bring them into a land in which they will reside. live. First half of Exodus, rescue. Second half of Exodus, relationship, what it means to have a relationship with God, know God better. And then beyond Exodus, they come to the land in which they will reside, which they will live. And so over this next term, these next 20 chapters, we're going to be looking about, thinking about God's people having been rescued. What does it mean to have a relationship with God? We're going to think about how God's people are to live, to reflect being people of God, and how God's people can live with a holy God when they are a sinful people. But today, we're going to be thinking about how they are to live, reflecting their God. So God's new people are rescued for a new life. And let's turn to the chapters that we've had read for us. It will help you to have a Bible open in front of you and to look at those verses that we've read and follow along with me. These chapters are called the Book of the Covenant. That's what it's called at the end in chapter 24. These verses on the law. God's revealed his 10 commandments to his people. He spoke to Moses and wrote them down on 2 tablets of stone. That's what we looked at last year. And now in these next few chapters, he's explaining more what it means to obey those 10 commandments in a bit more detail. He's going through different situations. It's called case law, different cases, okay? If this happens, then you should do this. So, if you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years, and so on. Case law, different situations. And he doesn't explain every single situation. They're just illustrations of kinds of situations, typical situations, because God's people are to use wisdom. So, okay, God's told us about that. He hasn't told us about this, so we need to use wisdom to work out what we do in this situation. That's about Hebrew servants, but what about non-Hebrew servants? Use wisdom for that. And these 3 chapters of case law, they cover a whole load of ground. They cover crimes of killing, crimes of assault, crimes of theft, how to treat people who belong, treat people who work for you. They cover a whole load of different situations because God is concerned for all of life. God's not just concerned about the Sunday or the Sabbath or the times when you come together to worship him. God is concerned about every single day, about every aspect of life. These chapters begin and end with worship. So the first few verses, chapter 20, verses 22 to 26, that's the start of the Book of the Covenant, deals with an altar. Well, first of all, it says, don't make any gods alongside me, talking about a commitment to him, and then describes the kind of altar you're to build. Then the end of this Book of the Covenant, chapter 23, verse 13, he starts again to talk about worship, the worship of, through religious festivals, sacrifices to God. So these verses begin and end with those things that are more commonly described as worship. The point is, these laws are for a people who are already in a relationship with God. People who are already worshiping God, who've already been rescued by God. So it's not about, hey guys, here's the best way to live if you want to get close to God. It's, these are laws for people who have been rescued by God to show them, here's how you live, reflecting the kind of God that we have. This is probably quite obvious, but I'll say it anyway. These laws are not our laws. They were given to the Israelites who'd just been rescued from Egypt, camped under Mount Sinai, and made a covenant with God through Moses. They were a people who became their own nation, who lived off the land as pastoralists, as agriculturalists, surrounded by neighbors who, to worship their gods, had orgies and made child sacrifices. So this law is for a different time and place. So is it just interesting history, or for some of you, not even interesting history? Well, certainly not, because it's in the Bible, and everything in the Bible is written for us. It's important because it teaches us about our God. The same God who was the God of the Israelites then, who is the unchanging God of us now. So let's think. What do we learn about our unchanging God? Let's go through a few things. We've seen it already. God's concerned with all of life, not just the seemingly religious bits. God wants his people to have an exclusive commitment to him. 20 verse 22, the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites this, you've seen for yourselves that I've spoken to you from heaven. Do not make any gods to be alongside me. Do not make for yourselves gods of silver or gods of gold. God wants unswerving commitment, exclusive worship. God cares about fair treatment of servants. 21 verses 1 to 11, he commands his people to treat their Hebrew servants well. They've got rights. After 6 years, they go free. What about female servants? They're not to go free, he says. Why is that? Well, probably, he doesn't say, but probably because in that society at that time, you didn't have single women on their own, surviving on their own. You had a woman who was in their father's house, who then got married and was in their husband's house. In that society, a woman on their own didn't happen. And if it did, they were a widow or an orphan, and they were vulnerable. So it wouldn't have been fair to free a woman in the same way it would have been fair to free a male slave. So obviously different in our society now. God cares about justice. 23:2. Do not follow the crowd in doing wrong. When you give testimony in a lawsuit, do not pervert justice by siding with the crowd. And do not show favoritism to a poor person in a lawsuit. Verse 6. Do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuits. Verse 8. Do not accept a bribe. God cares about justice. God cares about the weak. 22 verse 21 to 27. Do not ill-treat or oppress a foreigner, for you were foreigners in Egypt. Do not take advantage of the widow or the fatherless. If you do and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry. My anger will be aroused and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives will become widows and your children fatherless. If you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, do not treat it like a business deal. Charge no interest. If you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, return it by sunset, because that cloak is the only covering your neighbor has. What else can they sleep in? God cares about the value of each human life. 21:12. Anyone who strikes a person with a fatal blow is to be put to death. Life is so valuable that if you take someone's life, you pay the greatest penalty. God cares about just punishment. Crimes, sin deserve punishment. And we see here different kinds of punishment. We see, first of all, restitution. That's restoring what was lost to the victim and adding extra value. So 22 verse 1, whoever steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. That's restitution. Second, there's retribution, or punishment that fits the crime. 21, 22 to 25. If people are fighting and hit a pregnant woman and she gives birth prematurely, but there's no serious injury, the offender must be fined whatever the woman's husband demands and the court allows. But if there's serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Those words, eye for an eye, they're very well known, aren't we? Aren't they? We know them. And we think they sound brutal, probably. They're often quoted in that way. But the meaning is that the punishment should fit the crime. If someone's injured an eye, then a punishment equaling the value of the loss of an eye must be given. No more than that punishment, and no less than that punishment. Punishment should fit the crime. If this works, it's actually fairer than our modern justice system some of the time. Because in our modern justice system, I think often the punishment is greater than the crime. And sometimes the punishment is less than the crime. God says the punishment must fit the crime. That's justice for you. And there are other ways I think these laws are sometimes fairer than our modern justice system. But that's for a different day. God requires sacrifice. The law assumes that people are sinful, that they can't obey God all the time. And it provides for that by commanding that sacrifices be made. So the beginning and the end of these chapters describe sacrifice because human beings need a substitute to die in their place. And that's how they can have their relationship with God. By the means of a sacrifice. And God cares about celebration. 23:14. Three times a year you're to celebrate a festival to me. Times of remembering what God's done for them. How he's rescued them. Remembering that all food comes from him as he cares for them. Of the community gathering together as his people. And hearing his words spoken to them. And times of celebration. God cares about celebration. This law might seem otherworldly with its talk of not boiling a young goat in its mother's milk. It was for a different time, for a different people in a different place. But it teaches us about our unchanging God today. A God who cares about all of life. A God who wants worship of him alone and no one and nothing else. A God who cares that we treat people well. A God who cares about real justice. A God who cares about the poor and the vulnerable. A God who cares that punishment should be no more than what fits the crime, and no less than what fits the crime. A God who cares that his people can be in a relationship with him, even though they are sinful and he is holy. This is the same God as all those years ago. God didn't rescue the Israelites so they could go off and do whatever they wanted. He rescued them so they could live under him. These laws provided the secret to a new life, to a full life. If they could obey these laws, if they could treat one another like this, if they could love each other like this and love God like this, and when they mess up, they've got the sacrifices to keep them in a relationship with God, then how good a society would that have been? What kind of a peaceful and just and loving society would that have been? And they do commit to obey, don't they? That's what we see, chapter 24. 24 verse 3, when Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice, "Everything the Lord has said, we will do." Moses then wrote down everything the Lord had said. He got up early the next morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young Israelite men, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in bowls, and the other half he splashed against the altar. Then he took the Book of the Covenant, that's these chapters we've been reading, and read it to the people. They responded, "We will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey." Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, "This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." So God made a covenant with his people, and they committed, "We will do this. We will obey." These laws may not have been written directly for us, but they are a shadow of what we now have through Jesus Christ. The Old Testament Israelites were rescued from slavery for a new life with God. We too have been rescued from slavery for a new life with God. Just like them, we were slaves, slaves to sin, Satan, and death, worshipping other gods like the gods of the Egyptians. And God, in his love and mercy, rescued us by sending his son Jesus Christ to die on a cross for us. Defeating Satan, defeating death, defeating sin as Jesus died on the cross. God has rescued us. Not so that we might go and say, "Cheers, mate, now I'll take it from here." But so that we might have a new life in him. We're in the same situation. Not with these particular laws. We have a new covenant. And Paul writes about this in his letter to the Galatian churches. Galatians chapter 5. And he writes verse 13. "You, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free." There it is. We've been freed. "But don't use your freedom to indulge the flesh." We can't just do whatever we want. "Instead, serve one another humbly in love. For the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself." There we've got it. The law summarized as love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus said the same thing. Love your neighbor as yourself and love God with all your heart. Paul's talking about our horizontal relationships here. So he's concentrating on love your neighbor. The law which God gave through Moses was there to help the Israelites love their neighbor as themselves. If they love the neighbor as themselves, then they're not going to attack them. They won't let their bull gore their neighbor or gore their neighbor's bull. They won't steal from their neighbor if they love them. And we, like those Israelites, rescued by God and commanded by him to love God with all our heart and love our neighbor as ourselves. But the big difference between us and them, we have God's Spirit living inside of us. God's Spirit who enables us to obey. So Paul continues verse 16 of Galatians 5. "So I say, live by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the flesh desires what is contrary to the Spirit, and the Spirit what is contrary to the flesh. They're in conflict with each other, so that you're not to do whatever you want. But if you're led by the Spirit, you're not under the law." We have the Spirit. Like that little verse that you may have heard before that was written a long time ago. "Run, John, run, the law demands, but gives neither hands nor feet. Better news the gospel brings. It bids us fly and gives us wings. Run, John, run, the law demands, but gives neither hands nor feet." The law requires us but doesn't give us the ability to carry it out. Better news the gospel brings. It bids us fly and gives us wings so we can do it. The Lord of the Flies was an account of what happens to a society with no restraining influence whatever. Human beings returning to their natural instincts. Why does that happen? Because of sin inside of each one of us. Our need to assert ourselves against others as they heard the other group in the distance. When we see our other people, our instinct is to push them down and lift ourselves up. To love ourselves and to hate our neighbor. That is our instinct. Lord of the Flies said it. The true study showed it. But God rescued his people with a different aim. That they might live according to his law. A law that brought justice, peace, compassion, love, new life for people who are messed up and will keep on messing up, that they might live with God. God planned a new society, a society of blessing and love. Did it happen? Well, the people committed to obeying it, but then in chapter 32, we see what happened. Within 40 days of saying, we will do it, these people decided to build an altar, going against what God had said, and just living in debauchery and wild living. How long had their commitment lasted? Less than 40 days. But we can't look down on them because we are no better than them. We fail to love God with all our heart. We who have the Spirit in us, and yet so often we fail to see the fruit of the Spirit working itself up out in us. Paul speaks of that fruit. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. And yet we see that so limited in us who do have that Spirit. There's only one person in all of history who has obeyed this law, who has loved God with all his heart, and who's loved his neighbor as himself. Jesus. Only Jesus perfectly obeyed God's law. And so the Israelites under Moses, they answered God by saying, we will obey. And we can say a similar thing. With the help of the Holy Spirit, trusting in the grace of Jesus, we will obey. Knowing that only one person can say that and actually achieve it. Jesus. So will we build a new society here? God's new society. We can go some way to doing that, can't we? With God's Spirit living inside of us, we can make some steps towards building God's new society here on earth. But we look forward to God's perfect society in the new creation. And one man who thought a lot about that, and he preached a sermon thinking about that in particular, a sermon based on 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 13, a verse which says, and now these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. And his sermon was titled, Heaven is a World of Love. Let me read you some bits from it. He's talking about the ways in which love will be expressed in heaven, and he lists 10 different ways. 10 different ways that love will be expressed in heaven. He says, love will always be mutual. No one will ever be grieved that he is slighted by those he loves. The joy of love will never be dampened by jealousy. There will be no flattery, but always perfect sincerity. There'll be nothing that hinders our love. No dullness in our hearts, no corruption. Love will be expressed with perfect wisdom, with no indiscretions, no indecentness. There'll be nothing to keep us at a distance from each other. No separation wall, no difference of opinion or interest. We shall belong to each other, for we shall all have given ourselves to one another. We shall enjoy each other's love in perfect and undisturbed prosperity. There will be no poverty or affliction in heaven. There'll be no one to tempt us to hatred or misunderstanding. Everything shall conspire to promote love. And we shall forever be perfectly enjoying one another's love. And Edwards then goes on to speak of the fruit of that love. The first fruit of the love will be the most excellent and perfect behavior of people in heaven towards God and one another. Love is the sum of all good principles and therefore is the fountain from which all good actions proceed. If this love is perfect to the exclusion of all sin, so the fruit of it will be perfect behavior. Our life in heaven will be without the slightest sinful failure or error. We shall never turn aside to the right hand or to the left in the least degree from the way of holiness. Every action will be perfect in all its circumstances. Every part of our behavior will be holy and divine in matter and form and goal. We will be serving one another in perfect unity as a fruit of our perfect love for one another. That is where we are headed. God's new people who are imperfectly loving one another here, who are imperfectly obeying God here. And yet there will be a time when it's difficult for us to imagine. And yet Edwards, in that sermon, which would be a great thing for you to read if you can get hold of it, I can tell you where afterwards, helps us to think a bit about what it might be like if we perfectly love God's perfect new society. That's what he rescued us for. And so now we thank God for Jesus who perfectly obeyed and who died for us as our perfect sacrifice. We seek to love God with all our heart and our neighbor as ourselves. And we wait in hope for heaven, the world of love.